Okay, so you made a controversial comment. Yeah, what is a controversial comment?
What, that I hate weight and his interpretation of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I feel he makes it me have to explain shit too much. As it says to me, the Wheel of Fortune is always going to be fate stepping in, spinning the wheel for a better or worse outcome, depending on if it's upright or reversed. The Chariot's always just going to be swift movement and action and things going forward. But explaining that simply when you've got somebody who's sitting there toss-potting around about symbols, oh.
Right. Oh. So maybe we'll try and reduce the amount of toss-potting in the final show about the actual deck itself, the second half of the Major Arcana.
I haven't confused anybody. That's all I'm trying to say, is because I'm feeling like, because of the way he interprets things, I'm getting confused myself, and I know what these things mean. So I'm finding myself getting more and more frustrated, and I... Oh. Can we please just realise that they are very simple?
Yes, I'm sure that we can. Right, okay, so, we're in the second part of the Major Arcana, and in fact, because we're right in the midst of things, the warm-up here is going to be about the Major Arcana, so because there's a lot to talk about, but I think that actually there's a lot to talk about because there's deceptively little to talk about.
Yeah.
As you were saying to me in the last show, well, after the last show, that you were wishing that I would take more of a hand because I've got my own interpretation of that. This is true. Unfortunately, I know that when I come up across a lot of these symbols, I've tried to keep it light because I've done a lot of study for doing novels and stuff on alchemy and things like that. And I know also medieval history and how, you know, and Shakespeare used the Wheel of Fortune, things like that. But if I bang on about those, it's not going to make anything any clearer. It'll make them lighter. But at the same time, I suppose it's a different perspective again that is quite interesting. I think that basically one of the things is that what I think is the most thing that you should take away is that the simple meaning of the card, the very simple basic meaning of the card is that meaning.
Yeah.
But that all of the cards around that in the reading are going to provide context to that, and but not only that, that card from the Major Arcana is going to colour the way that the other cards are interpreted, and that's what makes these Arcana major.
Yeah.
Not reams and reams of psychological flim-flam about why these archetypal images are deeply rooted in the subconscious part of the monomyth, in manly symbols, monstrosity archetype, or whatever. Yeah. That's not really... I mean, it's interesting, by all means, you know, when you're doing further research in the cards, go and read about all that. But each card, in its simplest form, is what it is, and what matters is where it comes out in a reading. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, so after that pretty short warm-up, because we're quite warmed up already, we're going to start this week with, you know, can't say fairer than that, it's key 11, Justice, or key 8 in a pre-weight deck, but there we go. Oh, you're going to love this. Key 11, Justice, this is the key. Oh, well, let's go through the symbols first. We have in the weight deck a woman, another person sat in between two pillars on a throne again. A woman who has a crown on her head, sword in her hand, pair of scales in the other hand. It's the figure of justice from outside of the Old Bailey, and everywhere there's a figure of justice all the way around
and
the world.
And the scales represent which star sign?
Oh, Libra, of course.
Libra,
yes.
Right.
Okay. And we have, but I mean, again, my astrology to me, bollocks. So
I know, I'm just saying, if you realise, if you do know anything about astrology, it's helpful to know that that is the card of Libra.
But, we've got here on the Gilded Tarot, blind justice, so properly traditionally blindfolded, woman in white robe standing in front of an archway, there's scales again, she's got like beams of light flying from her hands, both of her hands, to a figure of the sun, which is like the axis upon which the scales rest. In the Renaissance Tarot, a much simpler dressed woman carrying a sword, and instead of carrying the scales, she's kind of balancing them on a finger and they go all the way round. And the key relates.
There we go.
As this card follows the traditional symbolism and carries above all its obvious meanings, there is nothing to say regarding it outside the few considerations of Bard 1. That's it.
Oh, well, I suppose at least, you know, he kept his neurotic ramblings to himself on this occasion. Justice is justice. Fair play, justice, honour, all the things that are justice. If you're awaiting a legal outcome, this card's great. If it comes out reversed, could mean it goes the other way,
well,
so be careful.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the...
That's about it. What more do you need to
know? I think what you once told me, which is a very important thing for people to consider, right, is that when justice comes out, if you can compare this with, for example, the Two of Pentacles.
Yeah.
The Two of Pentacles, or coins, whatever you want to call them, I prefer, the reason I keep saying all coins is because I prefer coins. I think Pentacles is a stupid name for a suit, which is about material security. Yeah,
okay.
Emotional security. Should be coins. Yeah, but anyway, that card is all about an arbitrated matter. And many justice type processes in the justice system could be represented as an arbitrated agreement. What justice takes a bit further, and you said this to me once, the justice card means justice will be served.
Yes.
Now, even if it comes out upright, okay, not that the reader knows this, but you might be, what's that bloke who ripped off bearings back? Nick Leeson.
Hmm.
Yeah? You're sitting in front of a fortune teller, a justice card comes out, and the fortune teller, or the tarot reader, fortune teller sounds a little bit Gypsy Rose Lee, says, ah, yes. This card is a card indicating that justice will be served. Whereas Nick Leeson, it doesn't matter whether it's upright or the other way up. You're going to crap your pants. Yeah? Because justice being served is not in your interest.
Yeah.
But that's it. Justice will be served.
Yeah.
And that's what the card means.
Yep.
Oh, now this card causes all sorts of hassles.
Oh, and I'm
everyone.
Sure this git's going to give us a great frigging rundown of about 5 pages worth of ramble about the hangman.
Right,
but here
okay.
we go.
This is key 12, the hanged man. Yeah. Now, the hanged man, you would expect from the name, if you are not familiar with the symbolism, and maybe you have a deck to follow along with here, and maybe it's the weight deck, in which case you would think that it's, you know, a man who has been hanged, you know, someone who's been punished, a prisoner. But no! No, not quite. This is a man who is hung from, well, in the case of the weight deck, a tree. He's wearing red tights. I don't know if that's of any symbolic significance. He has his hands clasped behind his back and his legs are in a kind of four with the left leg tucked behind the right above the knee. He has, he was what?
Clown hair.
Clown hair. Well, he has upside down hair because he's hanging from a tree.
Clown hair.
All right then. And he's got a halo as well. Moving on to the gilded tarot, in this the man is chained to a sun sign representation in a sky of dark clouds, and he's like hanging there from this kind of mythical device high in the sky. And in the Renaissance tarot, he hangs from, well, it is a sort of a gallows of sorts. But he doesn't look like a criminal. There is money falling from a pouch at his waist. He is doing his right leg behind his left behind the knee, and his hands are clasped behind his back. Even the man in the gilded tarot is actually doing the four thing with his legs, again with the right behind the left, and only in the weight deck is it the left behind the right. But the one in the gilded tarot, he's not clasping his hands behind his back. The key relates. The gallows from which he is suspended forms a tan cross, while the figure from the position of the legs forms a Philfot cross. There is a halo about the head of the seeming martyr. Should be noted first that the tree of sacrifice... Alright, let me finish. Is living wood with leaves growing from it. Secondly, that the face expresses deep enchantment, not suffering. Thirdly, that the figure as a whole suggests life in suspension, but life and not death. It's a card of profound significance, but all the significance is veiled. It's to be called falsely a card of martyrdom, a card of prudence, a card of great work, a card of duty. We may exhaust all published interpretations and find only variety. I will say very simply in my own part that it expresses the relation in one of its aspects between the divine and the universe. Right, okay.
Does the word willing sacrifice mean anything to anybody?
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's as simple as that.
Right, there's a little folk story that I think possibly I should add into the mix at this point. It's a
Reversed, stop and think.
Right.
Upright. Sacrifice. Willingly. Happily sacrifice.
Norse folk story. This is the easiest way to remember this interpretation of all. It is stated in the Norse chronicles that the god Odin, the king of all the gods, became king of all the gods in part, and the wisest being in the entire universe, because he hung himself upside down from the world tree and just hung there for, I can't remember, there's probably some numismatic number of days and nights. He lost his eye, he gave up his eye for wisdom. That's why he had one eye, because he gave it up for wisdom. It was all part of this process of initiation and, like you say, willing sacrifice. He went forth into that experience in order to snatch the wisdom back. Yeah?
Yep.
And then upside down, when you're saying stop and think, what you're saying is someone who's more like someone who's doing all the motions of doing that, but is possibly just trying to emotionally manipulate people or do whatever, you know. Yeah. Oh, I am such a martyr, please, you know, do this for me. And it's like, well, it's not working, so just get rid of it. It's not doing you any good because you're hurting yourself. You're not getting anything out of it. If you're going to hurt yourself, if you're going to put yourself, sacrifice something, and make sure it's for something in return, something great, something you put a personal price on. And that's what the card is all about. And I think one of the things is that esotericists of the 19th century particularly had this deep affinity for that idea of initiation, possibly because they didn't suffer enough themselves, so they felt they ought to do stupid things, like, you know, I mean, the absolute epitome of the reverse of this card is American frat house initiation ceremonies. What the hell is that about? You like all have to pretend that you're sucking off a goat or something in order to hang about with a bunch of idiots. I mean, that is the epitome, but it's that thing of initiation and sacrifice for attainment of some spiritual goal, maybe, which isn't certain. Is that not a good way then? Yeah,
perfect. Yeah. Oh, let's see what he's got to say about this one, because I guarantee you this is the card that everybody who doesn't know what it really means is terrified of.
Well, this is the card that in any given sort of vaguely occult thriller of the 1970s and 80s that was often shown on ITV.
Yes, you're going to die. Here's the death
it's
card.
Of course, no. It's very famous for being in Live and Let Die, isn't it? Yeah. You know, all death card, oh gosh. Yeah, it must mean death, because that's...
No.
You know, yeah. In the Rider Waite deck, we have the figure of death on the pale horse in the armour. He looks about very similar to the knights in the suits. And he's riding there into a sort of place. There's a bishop begging him, please, death, don't take them with children at their feet, blah, 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 blah. In the Gilded Tarot, similar sort of thing, but there isn't quite so much apocalyptic imagery round the horse's feet. In fact, you can't see the horse at all, but he's definitely wearing armour, bearing a shield and a flag in the same way. The Gilded Tarot goes for a completely different kind of thing. There's a dice. Not as in, like, has 1-6 on it, like a little raised platform, onto which is embossed a skull and crossbones with a griffin at either side and a phoenix. Phoenix rising from the flame. Oh, and the grandmother deck has the traditional Grim Reaper, like a proper reaper with a big scythe and a white rose and stuff on that. So that's, lots of deathly image, except obviously in the Renaissance Tarot, where it's a phoenix rising from the flame, which might have a clue. But let's just read what Waite has to say. What I'm saying is going to say something down to earth, grounded, sensible, and easy to understand, as usual. The veil and mask of life is perpetuated in change, transformation, passage from lower to higher, and is more fitly represented in the rectified tarot by one of the apocalyptic visions by the crude notion of the reaping Skellibob. Behind it, he really does write Skellibob as well, obviously. Behind it lies the whole world of ascent and spirit. The mysterious horseman moves slowly, bearing a black banner emblazoned with the mystic rose, which signifies life. Between two pillars on the verge of the horizon, there shines the sun of immortality. The horseman carries no visible weapon, but king and child and maiden fall before him, and a prelate with clasped hands awaits his end.
Bloody, 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 bloody. Will he shut up ever, do you think?
Well, when the book's finished, I think he really much has to, but, you know.
Card of Scorpio.
Yeah.
Transformation.
Yeah.
Renewal. End of situations.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that he says, that because the thing is, what I always find, okay, what I always find, because I'm a bit of a writer and I've studied stories, and I have, in fact, studied the universal monomyth, blah, 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 blah. Won't go into it now, maybe another time. But what I have found is that when someone writes something monumentally rubbish, when someone writes a story that is, to most people's mind, utter tripe, you will see, if you're a writer, places where the story tried to tell itself. The person's brain locked for a few meager seconds upon to the right path, and it was like, this is where I should be going. And then it can wander off in any number of directions. Yeah, and that always happens. Now, one of the things about stories that is always the truth, almost everything, because otherwise there would be no story, is that there is a world below which is off on a world above, and people start out in one and they move to the other. So they either start out in the world above and they move to the world below, or they start out in the world below and they move to the world above, or in the case of Trading Places, starring Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, you have two characters who swap places in both worlds, and that is how the story happens. And the point of the death card is it's that point at which you realise you're not in Kansas anymore. Yeah, it's like you've been in Kansas your whole time. You had nothing to contrast Kansas with. Suddenly you're in Oz.
Yeah.
And at that point, the person you were in Kansas is dead as a doorpost. Because you've suddenly realised that there is this whole other thing that you hadn't seen before. So in that sense, the you that existed before you made that leap forward is dead. But that doesn't mean they're like in a box, in a cemetery, with a gravestone, unless, of course, they're the character of, I can't remember the guy's name, but the alter ego in Stephen King's The Dark Half, yeah, who they do make a fictional grave for this writer's alter ego, in which he wrote extremely nasty, violent exploitation pulp, and then this guy comes out of the grave and stalks the writer, because that's the kind of great idea that Stephen King has. But there, again, he's talking about it, they have that transformation. He tries to break away, and, you know, in that story, because it's a horror story, that thing comes back to get him. But in all of these cases, all that death really represents is a fundamental transformation in worldview.
Yep.
Anything else?
No.
Yeah, you see, I happen today. It's one of those things. It's like The Fool and this one I know about. And death particularly, because people... Because it's probably, like, natural. I'm a curiosity, like, why kind of person. And if you come across the death card and people have this numinous feeling about it, obviously I was going to go and read up on it. And that is your first profound disappointment as a study. You think, oh, somebody knows something about death. What you find is that actually the death card represents something about somebody who knows nothing about, you know, what happens after you die, obviously, because they don't, because they're not dead when they produce it, so the death means something else. It's not yet enlightenment, but you realise that you haven't been enlightened before. It's the awakening of the feeling that you're not enlightened.
Yep.
Right, good. Okay, cool. Glad we managed to put that to rest, people. If you get death, that's what it means. It's nothing to do with actual physical being shot through the head.
And just so you know, if it's reversed, because that also scares people,
yeah,
it does not mean that these things aren't going to happen. What it means is like sluggishness, boredom, lethargicness.
Yeah. Well, you were meant to go to the Land of Oz, but you're stuck in Kansas.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing. The knowledge comes the other way.
You couldn't be
arsed. You start to feel this thing of, surely, you know, that song sums up, is that all there is?
Yeah.
You know, it's that feeling. Is this it?
Yeah.
Is there nothing else?
Yeah.
Okay? So that's what that is all about. Okay, here's a tricky one for everyone.
Not that tricky.
Well, yeah, no, it won't be in a minute, but it is tricky. If you were just leafing through, some of them you'd be going, yeah, the Fool, yeah, the Magician, yeah, the Wheel of Fortune, yeah, Death. Temperance. Right, okay. Waitstack has someone pouring an angelic figure with like a circle with a dot in it on their forehead and a triangle upon the chest of their robe. Big wings spread out, halo as usual, pouring water from one cup to another in a sort of garden thing, trailing feet in water. Moving on to the Gilded Tarot. The water again goes from the cup. It's weird though, there's a cup of water and a cup of fire, and the water kind of goes between the two, but the fire doesn't. I'm not sure what that's about. And the person holding the cups, who is not an angel in this case, but oh, guess what? A scantily clad woman.
Boobies alert.
I take it this is an Aquarius card.
It's the Sagittarius card.
Oh, great. Okay, that makes sense. It's coming out of some clouds. And in the Renaissance Tarot, we have opposites. We have black and red, black and white, white and red, red and gold and stuff. And the liquor that is in all the others is being transferred between two bottles. One is white and one is red. And the key relates. A winged angel with the sign of the sun upon its forehead, and on its breast the square and triangle of the septenary. Because, of course, we all know what a septenary is. Although some regard this angel as feminine, it is neither male nor female. It's held to be pouring the essence of life from chalice to chalice. There's one foot upon the earth and one upon water, so illustrating the nature of the essences. A direct path goes up to certain heights on the verge of the horizon. Above there is a great light, although through which a crown is seen vaguely.
Is there?
I don't think there is a crown seen vaguely. I think you really have to squint to see that, or maybe take some drugs. Not that I'm encouraging taking drugs, I'm just saying there is really no crown on that picture. Here is some part of the secret of eternal life as it is possible to man in his incarnation. Right.
Patience, harmony, adaptability.
Little alchemical story, maybe clear this up, yeah, for people. Because this is a proper alchemical card. Because alchemy, as everyone knows, is all about boiling things in pots. That is what alchemy is about. And part of that is, of course, there's no point just if you put something in a pot and you boil it, or you burn it, or you turn it to ash or whatever. I mean, that's being half an alchemist. Part of the joy of it is decanting things from one bottle to another, or one cup to another. And hence, if you remember back to the lovers way back when we were talking about that in the last show, we were talking about that union of the male and female elements to make the Philosopher's Stone. Well, there are 12 stages in the way of making that union between male and female happen. And at some point is produced a thing called the hermaphrodite. It's like, it's not a man, it's not a woman. It's not a proper unity of the two. It's in this stage before you get to the Philosopher's Stone. And this is where your stuff comes in, the whole point of why you make a hermaphroditic substance is because it is ultimately mutable.
Mm.
Right? Or changeable, adaptable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of the things that you've said, the reason that this card looks like this but represents what you said is because the important part, the part that's gone across all the cards, is the person decanting a liquor from one cup to another in various guises. And what that is supposed to represent is that creation of the ultimately mutable liquor, which takes, in the person who does it, patience, vigilance, virtue, all of those good things that are like study traits.
All the elements represented by Sagittarius as well. So that's why it's a Sagittarian card.
Ah, right, okay.
Reversed, it's stagnating.
Yes, you've missed the point. You've missed the point. Essentially, if you think about it, I mean, an easy way to think about it than alchemy is cookery.
Yeah.
If you cook something well, you have studied, you know, how flavours interact. And, you know, when they talk about all this stuff on MasterChef, they're really talking about some kind of fundamental chemistry. You cook something too long, it goes dry. You cook it too short, it's raw. You cook it just right, it's moist, but it's cooked. Yeah, things like that. Knowing that, how to prepare a recipe, is the summation of temperance. Temperance is about not too much, not too little, just enough to create that magic thing which is both one thing and another. It could be transformed into anything. So what it's saying is, if you are virtuous and vigilant, you will have that power. Cool, there we go. See, well, I'm glad I'm having a contribution here. I hope that
See, told you his contribution ways are better.
Well, it's not better. It's just a way of looking at things again.
Another card that scares people.
Oh, yeah, the Devil. 15, the Devil. And no, when you look at the Rider-Waite one, how can you not be scared by that? A big man with hairy legs and claws is perches upon a block. He's a proper devil with an inverted pentagram and everything, you know, holding up his hand. He's got fire and wings. He looks a bit, to be honest, he doesn't look evil. He looks a bit cross, to be honest. But, you know, still, scary. And there's more nudity in the Rider-Waite deck at this point, with a man and a woman with, you know, all in the all together, chained to the devil's stump, as it were. Then we move across to the Gilded Tower and we see, well, you know, I mean, that whole thing, I mean, obviously the guy's taken that thing of Lucifer being the morning star, and so this beautiful, athletic, angelic figure arises from the flame. But, of course, Lucifer is also cast down away from the sight of God, and so, you know, he's blind, he's blinded, and he's got big horns on a hat, and then behind him, a non-inverted pentagram, it is kind of gilded out of metal. In the Renaissance Tarot,
my favourite thing is the bottom of the deck.
I'm going to get to that last. I'm going to save this up. The bottom of the card, absolutely fantastic. But we have to work up to it. We have not exactly a devilish figure. It's very much the original horn pan figure dancing and frolicking among the leaves. And he is dancing among in a garden with nice ivy leaves. And, of course, as everyone knows, what grows in Pan's garden but the penis plant? For he is dancing through a field not of waving grasses, but of waving male members. Oh, yes. So, yes. Let's just see what Waite has to say of it. The Devil. The design is an accommodation, mean, or harmony between several motives mentioned in part one. The horned goat of Mendes, whoever he is, with wings like those of a bat, is standing on an altar. At the pit of the stomach, there is the sign of Mercury. Is that? Okay, whatever you say. The right hand... I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, cool, fair enough. One hand is upraised and extended, reversing the blessing which is given by the Hierophant in the fifth card. In the left hand, there is a great flaming torch inverted towards the earth. The reverse pentagram is on the forehead. There is a ring in front of the altar from which two chains are carried to the next two figures, male and female. These are analogous with those of the fifth card, as if Adam and Eve after the four. This is the chain and fatality of the material life. Apparently.
Bullshit, bollocks, and what a wanker.
Okay.
Devil cards. Right, let's deal with the horn thing. Right, the reason it's horns is because it's the sign of Capricorn.
Oh, right, yes.
It's a goat card. Right, this is a card of passion, sexuality, fertility, and all of those kind of things, basically. Which is why it's often represented as a really bad card, which is why I prefer my deck for this one, because the pan figure explains it better. It's the temptations, it's the lust, it's the passion, it's the things that, when Mr. Waite was alive, were considered sins, which is why they make it such a bad card, and it's not.
Well, I think the other thing about it is that I think Waite probably would have appraised it, because in the years following him making his deck, all of this stuff came out about the original horned god in Celtic mythology, Cernunnos, and, you know, his dual aspect, and Pan, and things like that. Mm. And that very earthy, you know, it's kind of like, if you look at those seven deadly sins, and you look at things like lust and gluttony, and it's like, you're not seeing 2 feet in front of your head, but I think in a way the devil card kind of says, but sometimes you need to let your hair down, man.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't always have your head in the clouds, staring at the stars, deeply contemplating the tower. For God's sake, go out, buy yourself a couple of beers and watch a heavy metal band. For God's sake. Because otherwise you're just going to be lame. And that's essentially what the card says, upright. And on the other side of that, if it's reversed, it kind of says, don't you think you've been overdoing it a bit?
Yeah.
Don't you think maybe, you know, when you're in your breakfast consists of hair of the dog with Alka-Seltzer in it. That's a time. It's a warning sign.
Yeah.
When 11ths is means a line of cocaine.
It's a misuse of the things that are considered sinful. If you know what I mean. It's reversed. It's the seven deadly sins. Gluttony and all that kind of stuff.
Funny you should say, but it's funny that it should come as a partner or next to in the major arcana, temperance.
Yeah.
Everything in moderation, including moderation. And if you go way over the top, you'll get it upside down. But if you go, you know, sometimes a little bit of what's bad is good for you. You know?
Passion doesn't hurt anything.
No. Okay. So, now here's another one. Now, this is one of the things, right, okay.
The Tower.
Yeah, that some of I always think that people who are like, ooh, the devil, ooh, death, you know, are like, they're not really that imaginative, because to me, I made a joke about, oh, and then I was first disappointed because I thought somebody was going to tell me something I didn't know about death. But that's the whole point. I knew looking at it, well, it can't just mean death. That's ridiculous. None of it, because it's not so much because of what it is, it's because the other cards seem so obtuse. And this card, the Tower, is one of the, you know, you're like, that doesn't look good. But you don't know why, or you don't know what that is. What is a tower got to do with this? In the weight deck, we have two figures falling from the top of the tower, where a crown has been blasted off by a fork of lightning, and there is fire in the tower, and they're falling down onto the rocks below. Moving on to the gilded tarot, a tower again exploded by lightning. Here the figure doesn't seem to have ever been in the tower. They're doing a kind of interpretive dance thing. It's a male figure, as you can tell from the musculature. But he's facing with his back, so you see buttocks rather than the other thing. And again, the same imagery repeated in a much more simple, stylized way in the Renaissance deck. The key relates. Occult explanations attached to this card are meagre and mostly disconcerting. It is idle to indicate that it depicts ruin in all its aspects, because this is self-evident. It's also said that it contains the first allusion to a material building, but I do not think that the tower is more or less material than the pillars which we've met with in two previous cases. Nothing suggests to me that this is the fall of Adam, but there is more in favour of the claim that it signifies the materialisation of the spiritual letter P. Is this Sesame Street all of a sudden? Anyway, Christian,
he drives me fucking bonkers.
Christian imagines that this is the downfall of the mind seeking to penetrate the mystery of God. I agree rather the Grand Orient, that is the ruin of the House of Life when evil has prevailed in it. Above all that, it is the rending of the House of Doctrine. It illustrates also in the most comprehensive way the old truth that unless the Lord build the house, they labour in vain that build it. Someone's been reading too much Bible. Okay.
Somebody's completely missed the point of this card.
Right, okay.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Right. It's blockages. It's barricades. It's the trials and errors of overcoming obstacles. It's like running a straight path and somebody puts hurdles in front of you. You know, that does not necessarily foretell a downfall. It just means you've got things to overcome. You've got things that need to be jumped before you can run any further.
Well, let's refer here. I'm going to refer for the first time to a biblical-style story. Yeah. Once upon a time, everyone in the world spoke the same language. And that was great because it meant that trade was very easy. And so what they did was they built a big tower for people to trade in. And God looked down and went, that seems like a big waste of time to me, or something. I'm going to destroy it with lightning. And so he destroyed it with lightning. And as people ran, they realized they were all speaking different languages, and that's how everyone spoke different languages at the end. Now, although this is a slightly weird story about how everyone came to have different languages, linguistically, apparently we all did once speak the same language, but it all kind of got fragmented into these uber dialects, and at one end of the scale you've got Mandarin, and at the other end you've got German, and you know, it's all a bit weird, right? But the essential point of it is that the languages in the story are depicted as what's put there to stop things being so easy for the pompous men. I think actually there is a thing, in because it's biblical, about how they would go, oh, stupid God, He didn't build a tower to do business in. Oh, let's see him do something like that. And that's why he destroyed it. But the point is that Providence has put something in your way to stop you being so smug. Or to stop something. To stop making any progress, basically. And that's what the tower represents.
Yeah, and reversed, it's just, it's complete, it's the opposite. It's complete freedom, but with chaos. It causes chaos because you've got the complete freedom to run around that track a million times. Well, what the hell are you going to do while you're running around that track a million times? At least when you've got the barriers to overcome, it gives you something to look towards overcoming. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I actually don't necessarily see the tower as the big downfall that everybody else sees it as. I see it as an obstacle. Yeah.
Well, I think the other thing is, I mean, you know, look at other tower, famous towers in the history of storytelling, like the tower in which Rapunzel was put. Yeah. That was definitely a barrier the prince had to overcome to get them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like ivory towers that intellectuals look out for. Towers are a representation of, I think, basically, we know, okay, inside ourselves, that, because what does the people think when they get a load of money and they've put together a civilization and they're all very happy about it? The first thing they think is, let's build a whacking great, honking great tower that stretches into the air, and the bigger the tower is, the more awesome we will be, and people will write books and take pictures of it and put it in a thing, or it'll be shaped like a gherkin and everyone will laugh at it. Yeah, but the point is that towers represent a pinnacle of human kind of material achievement, but at the same time, hubris. Man's kind of, well, why did you do that? Well, because, you know, I mean, it's showing off, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's it. It's all about, this is about showing off. Why are you doing this? What is it all about? And when the tower is destroyed, what it says to you is, you know, it's time to check yourself. Because this is ridiculous. What is this all about?
Yeah.
And so obstacles are there to give us, I mean, you know, we impose our own limits. It talks about the limits that we impose upon ourselves, limits that are imposed upon us by others, such as the Tower of London. I mean, it really means anything to do with what human brain thinks of in towers. So it's actually quite a deep card. But at its heart, what it says is limits, edges, boundaries, and the removal thereof. Or in the reversal case, you're so free, you've got no boundaries. And unfortunately, that means you kind of melt into the background. I mean, what are you going to do? You're lost. Right, okay. So, yes, having gone into that. This is the most contentious card in the Gilded Tarot that we've had.
Because it's got something called you.
Yeah, this is the Star, which in the Gilded Tarot has the most strident example of boobies in the whole of the Major Arcana, which is bizarre as far as I'm concerned. But actually, having said that, it's a regular boobathon. The Star across the board, there's more nipples than stars across these cards. So make of that what you will. In the Rider-Waite, then, we have a young lady. She's, well, this is the Aquarius card, isn't it? Because we've got a young lady taking water out of a, you know, out of a pool, or pouring it into the pool, or there's water everywhere anyway, and stars in the sky. Same sort of thing in the next one, but as the designer of this deck, Ciro Marchetti, has started to talk about the universe in Newtonian terms, a sort of clockwork universe. There's a clockwork star device in the air behind her. And the same sort of things coming again in the Renaissance deck, and the key
relates.
Oh,
let's listen to the idiot Babylon a bit, yeah.
A great radiant star of 8 rays is surrounded by 7 lesser stars, also have 8 rays. The female figure in the foreground is entirely naked. Her left knee is on the land and her right foot upon the water. She pours water of life from 2 great ewers, irrigating sea and land. Behind her is rising ground, and on the right a shrub or tree where a bird alights. The figure expresses eternal youth and beauty. The star is L'Etoile Flamboyante, which appears in Masonic symbolism and also on the menu at Gordon Ramsay's newest restaurant. That which the figure communicates to the living seen is the substance, the heavens, the elements. It has been said that truly the mottos of this card are waters of life freely and gifts of the spirit. So yeah, I feel a lot clearer now. No, I don't.
Right.
This is one of those ones.
Star, that's what they call you. Wish fulfillment.
Oh, right, when you wish upon a star.
Yeah, wish fulfillment.
Disney.
It's as simple as that. It's, you know, it's the one, actually, I actually make people, if it comes out for them, make a wish on it, because it is a wish fulfillment card. It's also hope, faith, healing, everything that comes with, like, that whole wish fulfillment thing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's a great card. Even reversed. Because reversed, like the Minor Arcana, it just means it's not quite ready yet, but you've still got a wish or a dream that can be fulfilled.
Right, okay. So all that when you wish upon a starter. You know, that seems pretty reasonable. And I mean, yeah, people talk about stars. I mean, if you're going to go for the astrological thing...
I mean, I can sing a number of songs that year. Why do you have to go and put stars in their eyes, stars in their eyes, stars in their
yeah,
eyes?
Yeah, that's not
for
singing.
A star. But it's that wrong. Thing of, you know, things coming true, dreams, hope, wishes, you know, things that seem unobtainable, finally coming to, you know what I mean, fulfulfillment, things... that are good in
I think
life.
It's actually wrapped up in that whole... I mean, there's a whole celebrity mythos. And the part of it that you've kind of skipped over a bit. If you think of another famous star image in a song, I was born under a wandering star. And then, yeah. You know, the power of love, the Frankie Goes Hollywood thing where they have the three wise men following the star. That it's, you know, following your heart as well and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you hear the trite, sentimental dialogue at the end of something about rags to riches, someone who becomes a Hollywood star, they go, well, you just have to follow your heart and believe in your dreams and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, so there we go, right. Moving on, once we've had a star, obviously the next best place to go is the moon.
Pisces!
So we have the moon here, and in the right of way we've got dogs barking at the moon, towers in the distance, moon in the sky, but there's a scorpion coming out of the water there.
Yeah.
But it's a Pisces card, alright.
It's the card of Pisces, because you have to remember they're all water signs, so they're all interlinked with each other.
Right, okay. And the moon in the...
Scorpio, Pisces, Cancer are interlinked.
The moon in the Gilded Tower again, the moon being an astronomical body, is from a device. This is a slightly different device to the others. It's the first time that the Ciro Marchetti has represented sort of a televisual kind of idea, because the device is actually at the bottom in the water with all of the, you know, like the sun, the star, the moon, and all of the device stuff. And then the moon itself appears in a kind of globe above, as if it's being generated by this machine. The two towers are there again, as are the dogs barking at the moon. And instead of a scorpion, we have a crab coming out, which probably makes more sense in that case. It's a lobster. Oh, right, no, it's not even a scorpion in the first one. It's all lobsters. Lobsters
Rock
or
lobster.
Crabs. We've always got these two towers, and the moon, and the dogs, and the lobster. So there are some minor differences, but that's it.
The two dogs are a representation of the two fish in, you know what I mean?
The key says, the distinction between this card and some of the conventional types is the moon is increasing on what is called the side of mercy to the right of the observer. It has 16 chief and 16 secondary rays, apparently so. The card represents life of the imagination apart from the life of the spirit. The path between the towers is the issue into the unknown, the dog and the wolf. Oh, dog and wolf, apparently. That's why one is biscuit coloured and the other is beige. That's why. are the fears of the natural mind in the presence of that place of exit when there is only reflected light to guide it. Right.
Right. Shall we go into this?
Yeah.
Right. This is Pisces as it is, right?
Right.
Because this is what Pisces are. They're the daydreamers. It's the daydreaming. It's the kind of staring into the water, kind of looking for answers kind of card, if you know what I mean. In this key, it relates quite easily. Dreams, visions, illusions.
Right. Here is the thing that I would always... Because I do actually... I mean, this is another one that I know. I mean, moon, you know. Moon is moon, right? When you talk about moon, the first thing that is associated with that, or the first thing that has sprung from the concept of moon, is lunatic.
Yeah?
Someone... who, you know, that's a very unkind word in these times.
Actually, if that comes out reverse, yeah, it's quite right.
Yeah, no. But it's a very harsh word. But we're talking about the moon is a symbol of illusion. Juliet in Romeo and Juliet tells Romeo not to swear by the moon. Swear not by the inconstant moon, she says. for the reason that one day the moon is full, next day the moon is gibbous, the day, a week after that is crescent, then it disappears entirely.
Yeah.
To Elizabethan mind, that was, you know, the sun's always the sun. I mean, it's there. I mean, that, there is no difference to the sun. But the moon kind of plays silly buggers, and it changes shape all the time, and it disappears and it comes back. People thought that women's bodies were, you know, that periods and that, because it followed the cycle of the moon, was that their women were influenced by the moon. We know that the tides are influenced by the moon. Basically, and also, of course, werewolves change under the light of the moon. It is, the moon is this kind of mysterious thing of illusion.
Yeah.
And looking in the wrong direction, or the hall of mirrors. That's why Ciro Marchetti's put the moon in a visor. You're not actually seeing the moon in the sky. You're seeing the moon on a television. It's an illusion. It's a representation.
Yeah.
And essentially, I think that one of the reasons why, I mean, the moon gets a bit of a bad rep here. And the reason is because people who look at the tarot are supposed to be looking at spiritual enlightenment. And the moon represents everything that is navel-gazing. You're not going anywhere near spiritual enlightenment. You're just having a bit of a think about nothing in particular.
Yeah.
And you, it is a warning. Don't mistake one for the other.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
I mean, reversed again, it's kind of like... As she said, lunatic. It's
you
kind
were
of,
a loony.
Yeah, it's kind of that chaotic side of that dreaminess and not being able to put your feet on the ground, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, so there we go. That covers the moon, I think, pretty much.
The sun.
Right, in the Rider-Waite deck. This is a great card. I love this card in the Rider-Waite deck. You've got some little, like, cute little child on the back of a pony with a big red blanket. In front of a bunch of sunflowers and the sun. In the Gilded Tarot, we have the sun as the centre of this gigantic cosmic machine in which all of the other things are represented there. And in the Gilded Tarot, we have two little cherubs playing under the face of a leonine sun. And the key relates. A naked child mounted on a white horse displays a red standard. It is the destiny of the supernatural East, and the great and holy light which goes before the endless procession of humanity, coming out from the walled garden of the sensitive life and passing on the journey home. The card signifies, therefore, the transit from the manifest light of this world, represented by the glorious Son of Earth, to the light of the world to come, which goes before aspiration and is typified by the heart of a child. Great, I feel much clearer now. Again.
Eat nice, easy one again. Hope. Purity. Fulfillment of honesty. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Trueness. You know, truth. You know, it's as simple as that.
Well, anything that we think about the sun... as in the actual sun, not the newspaper in the UK of the same name, is essentially, I mean, that it's what's summed up here. It's like the sun, the light of a new day, the dawn, you know, and it comes up and then there's the
I
sun,
mean,
the
out
sunshine.
The sun comes life anyway.
Yes.
Because without the sun, there would be no life.
And I think that my deck has an interesting perspective on it, that it's the centre of this great cosmic machine,
yeah.
That it's the power, the heart that beats and it fulfills. You know, it's just basically talking about your source of all life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got the warning right there. Sun can burn. You're Icarus, you fly too close, your wings melt, you fall into the sea.
Which is why reversed, yeah? It can be quite bad.
Yeah, exactly. The sun takes and gives, you know, gives everything and takes it away just as much.
Yeah.
And that's the whole top and bottom of the sun, that it is that great power without which none of this would be happening, but mess with it at your peril. Okay, card 20, Judgment. On the right, yeah, this is another one that's kind of numinous, and if you've been doing Bible study, probably quite scary. If you haven't, it's just like, that looks quite scary. Because on the Rider-Waite deck, which is one most people see first of all, we have an angel blowing a trumpet, which strangely has the English flag upon it. But there we go.
It has the St. George Cross.
Yeah, St. George Cross. But, you know, dead people, who are signified as dead by being beige although obviously on the moon card that meant you were a wolf, but hey, whatever. All these beige people rising up out of coffins in response to the trumpet. In the Gilded Tarot, spirits are called by the trumpet, the you know, same sort of imagery. In the Gilded Tarot, what's coming forth at the blast of the trumpet are little winged hearts. So there we go. And the key relates. I have said that this symbol is essentially invariable in all tarot sets, or at least the variations do not alter its character. The great angel is here encircled by clouds, but he blows his bannered trumpet, and the cross as usual is displayed on the banner. The dead are rising from their tombs, a woman on the right, a man on the left, and between them their child, whose back is turned. But in this card there are more than three who are restored. It should be noted that all the figures are on in wonder, adoration, and ecstasy expressed by their attitudes. It is the card which represents the accomplishment of the great work of transformation in answer to the summons of the supernal, a summons that is heard and answered from within.
I like to see it slightly differently.
Okay.
The easiest way for me to put it to anybody else out there is this is the card of karma.
Right.
If reversed, you know that bad little shit you did? It's coming back.
Right.
If upright, this is the reward for staying true.
Right. Now,
this is the resurrection, the calling forth, and your receiving of your better things and your goodness and your things have come back to give you good.
Now, we're taking a thing, right, for two concepts I'd like to pick up on there. First of all, judgment as distinct to justice. If we remember back to the justice card, which, you know, is pretty much regarded as justice will be done.
Yeah.
Well, here we have judgment, and judgment doesn't have anything to do with justice. Justice is a man-made concept. Yeah. Judgment is outside of you. It's the thing that is outside.
Yeah.
And you also said this is the card of karma. Now, although karma...
No, that's just the way I like to explain
it. I'm just saying. You mentioned the concept of karma.
Yeah.
Now, of course, what goes around comes around. It's kind of like it's a consequence of karma. It's like a side effect rather than the actual thing itself.
Yeah.
The best explanation of karma I ever heard is in fact the explanation given in the final Matrix movie, The Matrix Revolutions, which, you know,
everybody hated. Well, so everybody watched it.
Yes, exactly. So that's a bit of a problem. But in that, a character is given the statement, karma means simply what I am here to do.
Yes.
Right? And you look about yourself and all the choices that you have in your life, wherever you are, then you have a choice to get involved or to stay out of things. You have a choice to try and affect things for the better or the worse. And one of the important things is this. You decide that in order to improve your spiritual learning and standing, you are going to go and help out the elderly, and you go to an elderly person's house and you make them a cup of tea, and you accidentally, but without thinking, put the tea on a tea cloth which is dangling down, and the old person's dog comes into the kitchen, grabs the cloth in its teeth, gets knocked on the head by the scalding hot tea in the cup, dies on the spot. The karma there is not reflecting on you. You were trying to make an old person a cup of tea, the dog happened to die. Right? You do not have to pay the price for that. If, on the other hand, you decide you don't like the little shit and you poison it with rat poison, that's on you. So it's not, oh, I did something and then this happened and now I'm going to have to pay the price whether I meant it to or not. If you know there's a fairly good chance something bad may come out of your action and you're trying to play the game that perhaps it won't, the rule of karma says that actually it's going to come back and get you anyway, because you knew what you were doing when you walked into it.
Which is why, in a way, Waite put it as a calling of your own heart.
Yeah.
It's the heart's decision of the judgment, if you know what I mean.
So, yeah, I mean, basically all it says is you might have by the consequences and choices you've made in the past, to find yourself up to your neck in it. Well, if you want to change that, now's the time to make the choice to start changing it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you don't, then, you know, so be it. Yeah. It's on your own head. And that's what this card is all about. It's all about, you know, the difference between right and wrong, and you got to do it. You know, you got to make your own choices, but then you got to live with the consequences. So, you know, whatever. So that's what that is all about. Okay, and finally, we're at the very last card in the deck. We have come all the way from the Ace of Cups through 76 cards to get to this card, Key 21, the World. The World, the weight deck, and I'm noticing this here possibly for the first time, repeats the animal motifs of the Wheel of Fortune, which is what where we began this episode on, isn't it? Yeah. And indeed, there is a wheel-like wreath around a female figure. And I like the way that actually, whenever Waite wanted to tell you this is a female, when the title of the card was not specific, he decided, yeah, put some boobs on her. That'll tell everyone what's going on. Right? So that's what he's done. And, she's wreathed, although, you know, revealing her boobies in a sort of cloth, and she holds a scepter in both hands in the centre of this gigantic glory wreath, and the angel, eagle, bull and lion are all around that circle. 21 in the Gilded Tarot is a sort of gymnast figure, again holding the scepters, masked figure. It's indistinct whether this is part of a device, as some of the other cards have been, or whether it is actually like a big triumphal, like the top. There's a wreath again, and it might be at the top of a torch, like a sort of Olympic torch or something like that, but we don't know. In the Renaissance Tarot, the wreath is there again. And in fact, it repeats the symbols, the angel, the eagle, the bull and the lion around that. We've got the sun and the moon at the meeting at the bottom of the wreath. This world character, again, female, again, wrapped in a band or a sort of sash, but carries only one thing, and it's not a wand. It's a scroll. And the key relates. As this final message of the Major Trumps is unchanged, and indeed unchangeable in respect of its design, it has been sufficiently described already. It represents the perfection, the end of the cosmos, the secret which is within it, the rapture of the universe when it understands itself in God. It is also the state of the soul and the consciousness of divine vision, but these meanings are without prejudice to that which I've said concerning it on the material side. Great. So that doesn't sound like a contract. I have not attempted to present the symbolism in what called three worlds, that of divinity, of the macrocosm and the microcosm. I have taken cards from the high plane of the... Yeah, okay. Of their more direct significance to man, who in material life is on the quest of eternal things. I have not attempted to rectify the position of the cards in their relation to one another. The zero, therefore, appears after number 20, but I have taken care to number the world or universe as 21. And that's it.
La-di-la-di-la-di-la. God, he's so full of it, isn't
he? Well, you know, he was an excitable boy. I think that's the problem, you see.
Right. Easy as pie. This is the easiest card. And the way I tell it to people is this. You hold the world in your hands.
Right.
All opportunity is there.
The world is your mollusk.
Yeah. Use it.
Or other shellfish.
Use it. The world is there for you to grasp. Things are there for you. It's a great spiritual card because it shows great spiritual awareness and things like that. But on the whole, it is that ability to be able to fulfill things and to be able to grasp the world by the hand and go, this is mine. Reversed, it's the same sort of thing, but it means that the world isn't quite fertile yet. I think the best way of putting it is that. It's not quite ready yet. You're grasping opportunities before they're there. This is, the world is there for your taking. The world is there in your hands. What do you want to do with it? Yes. Take the opportunities, take the things that are there.
All I would add to that, right, here is an important thing. The world is all around you. And at the end of the day, there's two parts to everybody's world. Yeah, there's the bit inside your head, and there's the bit outside your head. And a lot of spiritual relationship is to do with the fact that outside your head, things exist which at any given time, you can't conceive of them, you can't imagine them, you can't comprehend them, they're not for you to know, they're mysterious, and they're unknown, and the unknown things are sometimes concerning, and spiritual concerns try to make you at peace with that. Because there is also, by the same thing, when you look outside into the outside world and you see that there are things that are hidden and mysteries and things like that, that reflects back in you. And you realise there are things about yourself that you do not know and will never know. And there are things that you cannot know. And that whole spiritual relationship between you and that represents the whole of existence. And when you kind of go, well, there's stuff I don't know about and I'm never going to understand it and nobody's ever going to understand it and it's out there and it's just weird and it's not for a human brain to comprehend, but the rest of it, I'm not going to sweat. That's the world. That's when you've got it. That's when you've got it. You've got everything. You've encompassed it all in your head, including the things that cannot be encompassed in that simple statement of, I'm not going to sweat it. I'm not going to break my back trying to understand things I was never meant to understand.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the world, it's like I said in stories, we always represent the world. There are two worlds. And, I mean, it's interesting, in fact. I mean, one of the ones that people deride quite a lot, actually, in retrospect, is that with this monomyth thing that Joseph Campbell came up with, George Lucas made Star Wars. And they're like,
Leave it alone now, George. Put it down. Yes. Put it away. Put it down. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is how one can get infected by messing around with powerful magic, yeah? This is something that shaped a lot of people's life experience and their whole, you know, and they got into it. And then later on, George Lucas, like, tried to get... It's interesting, really. That Star Wars movie that became this alchemical gold, that was the act of the fool. He was walking where angels feared to tread. At the time when he made Star Wars, nobody made science fiction movies like that. Nobody did that, this stuff. And they did the concept of a summer blockbuster. He invented it with that one stroke. Later on, he tries to attain the status of a magician. He tries to do it himself, deliberately, knowing what he's doing. What does he come up with? Jar Jar Binks. So, yeah, I mean, you know, that shows you how far George Lucas's spiritual development actually went. You see? That's what it's all about. But it's interesting that even there, where it's all taking place in an apparently consistent world where Luke lives on Tatooine and everyone else lives in space, at the beginning of the story anyway, that's what we're saying. Darth Vader, he lives in a spaceship in space. It's a metal, cold environment. That's where he exists. Luke, on the other hand, is baked by like three suns in a desert land, an actual land. And he works, interestingly enough, in this desert, in a moisture farm, in a farm. All of these things, like, there's so much significance. The whole point is that as time has gone on, it's become plain to everyone that Lucas didn't actually understand what the significance of what he was writing actually was.
Put it down, George. Put it down.
But the fact of the matter is that this is what the world kind of represents. It's that whole thing of not just what you can see, but also what you can't see. It's the other world. And when you can understand and comprehend it, what Joseph Campbell said at the end of all the stories is that the ultimate end is when you have someone, the hero of the story becomes the master of the two worlds. That is, understanding everything about what can be understood from the perspective of having walked through the land that cannot be understood. And that is the end and completion of all matters, as that is the end of us going through the tarot deck. But not quite the end of the tarot podcast. we have one more show to do.
Yes.
And in that show, we shall be just taking a look back at everything we've done, talking about steps forward, what we're going to do in the future, and also there will be my great internet roundup for those of you who are like, you know, you may have listened to the shows and you're like, yeah, I'm really keen, you want to run out there. I'm going to tell you, like, I've been in your position, we've been doing the show, I've been going out there and having a look around. I'll tell you what's on the internet, see what's going on, because that's really the whole point. The whole point of the show and what it's supposed to plant is the seed of discussion. So that's what's going on there. And we hope you've enjoyed going through the cards with us. And also next week we're going to be giving
please
you a little
preview.
Please
burn your Rider-Waite little books, key things, and just do it more instinctively, because I'm sorry, I don't know what he was on, but it must have been quite strong.
This is a good final note for this thing. You, inside yourself, you will understand. I mean, basically, we've been through the Major Arcana. We've gone through and we've consolidated those meanings and we've talked about it. You may have some of your own ideas, and your own ideas are fine. Yeah? They should be consistent with some sort of something that we've said, but they might be an offshoot of those ideas that we've talked about. Books, of a whole, whether they're as confusing as Waite's Key to the Tarot, or whether they are a more simple guide or something that you've picked up in a shop, they are there as kind of like pen and ink, paper and ink sounding boards for your own ideas. If you are being played by the book, that is, you are coming out and learning the book by rote and making notes like that, that's where you're making the mistake. I tried it, it didn't work out for me. A book is there to consolidate what you already know. I've had a really good experience. I don't know. I mean, have you enjoyed doing the talking
to the
cards?
Yeah, I don't mind. You see, it's hard for me because a lot of people would probably want to burn me as a heretic for the tarot, if you know what I mean, because they're so precious about it. And it's so easy. They make it so much more complicated than it actually is. And to me, just to be able to go, look, take a look at it this way. It's simple. It's this. Find the things that relate to each other in the cards. Find the things that, you know, fives all relate to each other, tens all relate to each other. Figure it out that way. You know, use your instincts a bit more. Doesn't mean the way I do it is perfect either. You'll come up with your own way.
Yeah, and that's basically where we should really leave it. It's like, what we're saying is, you have to have your own ideas. You have to learn the associations yourself, look at the cards, understand them. I hope we've been some help in that. We're still open for comments. And we'll talk a bit more about the way forward for the Tarot podcast. Have a final sort of tie-up of all those things. Do a preview of our Enneagram show in next week's show. Until then, enjoy. The Tarot Podcast is copyright Monkey Podcast Island 2008. You are free to use this podcast for any non-commercial purposes. The opening and closing themes are covered by a Creative Commons license, details of which are available via our website. All content produced by Monkey Podcast Island is available at monkeypodcast.blogspot.com.